Welcome to Criminal Sexual Conduct, What Needs to Change. This four-hour documentary is supported by a grant from the Corporation of Public Broadcasting and is co-produced by WUVS LP and Connie Nesbury International LLC. RAIN statistics report that an American is sexually assaulted every 98 seconds, and every 8 minutes that victim is a child. Meanwhile, only 6 out of every 1,000 perpetrators are sentenced to prison. According to the Crime Victims Center, 1 in 3 girls and 1 in 6 boys are sexually assaulted before the age of 18. It is estimated that there are 60 million survivors of child sexual abuse in America. High rates of depression, anxiety, substance abuse, dissociative disorders, interpersonal dysfunction, sexual problems, and suicidal ideation have all been identified to varying degrees among men and women who survive child sexual abuse. Through conversations with survivors and experts, we explore solutions to the pandemic of criminal sexual conduct, while recognizing that this is a global issue. Our hope is that this program will raise awareness of the issues, promote compassion through understanding, and encourage conversations in communities about what changes need to be made so that everyone is safer from criminal sexual conduct. This is Connie Nesbury, your moderator. For statistics or support, call the RAIN hotline at 800-656-4673 or visit their website at RAIN.org. That's RAINN.org. For full speaker bios and transcripts of this broadcast, visit ConnieNesbury.com. That's ConnieNesbary.com. This hour, entitled Survivor Healing Journeys, features Donna Jensen, artist, activist, and author of Healing My Life from Incest to Joy, Bill Murray, founder and CEO of the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse, Sarah Hodges, owner of Interform Fitness Incorporated and creator of the Beautiful Shame campaign, and Rachel Thompson, owner of Bad Redhead Media and author of award-winning bestsellers, Broken Places and Broken Pieces. Her articles regularly appear in the Huffington Post, the San Francisco Book Review, and other publications. Rachel is the creator of a weekly Twitter chat on Tuesday evenings with the handle #sexabusechat. For full biographies on our speakers and transcripts, visit ConnieNesbury.com. Welcome, Donna. Tell us about your story and your healing journey.
Sure, I'd be glad to. The physical abuse started when I was an infant. The sexual abuse started, and my father was my offender. It was from when I was 8 until age 12. The first thing I did, which I didn't know was part of my healing at the time, was I left home right out of high school. I moved across the country to California and found a job. But my healing journey in seriousness didn't start until my early 30s. I was in the women's movement and in consciousness-raising group back in the 1970s, and we started telling each other things that women hadn't shared a lot, and that's when I started talking about it, and I came to see that I really had to do some serious healing from this wound if I was going to have the life I really wanted. So I went into therapy the first time in my mid-30s, and I also did a lot of what was called co-counseling at the time, so I had peer counseling. That was a very big part of my healing process. Two other things in my life that I talk about as being healing. One is writing about what I experienced, and just the act of writing became a way of getting it out of myself onto the page, you know, getting it out of my guts and getting out of my head. The act of writing is like writing is medicine. Also, being an activist, being in the women's movement and standing up for injustice for whole groups helped me to see I needed to stand up for my own self. So just doing activism has also been a healing thing. And then lastly is then building a family of choice, knowing that I can't have the biological family I want and deserve. And so I have a family of choice that I've built over the last, you know, I'm 70 now, so I've been doing that since my 30s.
If someone doesn't get treatment, they try not to deal with it. What do you think are the consequences of that?
I think the consequences for not going for the healing of this trauma and this wound, you suffer in, I mean, each person suffers in their own way, but it takes so much energy to hold down this secret and the results of being harmed in that way, that if you don't get it out of you, I mean, I think there are lots of ways that one can be very self-hating and self-harming. Another is you can take it out on other people. I mean, I think most perpetrators were harmed themselves before they became perpetrators, which doesn't mean, I don't mean to say that everyone that suffered childhood sexual abuse is going to become an abuser. I don't mean that in any respect, but I do think the other side is true, that most perpetrators have been harmed, have been abused in one form or another. Because I don't think people are born that way.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think any baby is born feeling like they want to hurt someone.
Exactly, exactly. I think also another consequence of not healing from this experience affects the kind of relationship you have. I mean, I can think about the relationships I had with men before my healing as opposed to after is enormously different. I basically mostly didn't trust any men, and many of them I was afraid of, and many of them made me angry, and it didn't take much. So,
yeah, because did you generalize for a while that, you know, all men were like your dad?
Yeah, most men. I never said all, because I did have the most tender-hearted, dear grandfather who was extremely important in my life. But yes, most men were a threat. And it doesn't help that a lot of men have misconceptions about what they're entitled to do and say and act. So a lot of them sort of reinforce my own fear.
Why do you think criminal sexual abuse is underreported?
Because the victims are afraid. And it could be fear of all kinds of things. I mean, my father told me, after every rape, if you tell anyone, I'll kill you. So, and that was at, you know, starting at age around 8 years old. So it took a long time for me to find the strength to tell someone, because that message goes in pretty deep. And I think most people that are sexually abused are given really strong messages to keep quiet, not just by their offenders, but by the culture at large. You know, families don't want to hear about it. Communities don't want to hear about it. So I think that's why it's underreported.
And what do you think is the extent of the problem?
Well, you know, because so much is underreported, so what do we know? It's 1 in 3 girls and 1 in 7 boys. That's, I think, what the CDC is saying. And then they're saying that's like 10%. I think everybody is connected to a survivor, but not everybody knows the survivors in their life. You know what I mean? If those survivors are keeping their stories secret, you know, you could have a sister or a brother, or a good friend, a colleague. It's all very closed.
What do you think would help end child sexual abuse?
Well, I do believe is that more and more survivors have to come out. And I know how hard it was, because I've been on the other side of keeping the secret. So much has been taught by the gay and lesbian movement. The more people came out, the less the culture could pretend that it wasn't that big a deal. And I think that's the same for stopping child sexual abuse. We've got to first face the fact that there's a heck of a lot of survivors in our culture. So that's, to me, the first step. I mean, that's why I wrote my play, and that's why I wrote my book.
Well, tell us more about your play and your book.
So I've been in a writer's group for 20 years, and I finally decided that the way I was going to further my activism was to do it for the arts. And so I wrote a one-woman show that's based on my story of surviving incest, and it's called What She Knows, One Woman's Way Through Incest to Joy. And I have a guitarist, a wonderful master guitarist named John Sheldon, and he accompanies me. So there's a lot of music in the play, there's a lot of humor, and there's also some tough information about what it means to be the survivor of incest. Then I come back out and have a dialogue with the audience about what they've experienced. And I've never done a performance where some people didn't come up to me and say, you're the first person I'm telling that I'm a survivor. And then we also run writing workshops as a follow-up to the play for any survivors that want to work with me a bit about finding their voice through writing. And I do this at conferences and colleges. I do it at a facility for boys who've been convicted of sexual offense.
What's the name of your book?
It's called Healing My Life from Incest to Joy. And it's all the healing paths and experiences and people that I've been through and with to heal from this and live a life that makes me happy.
What consequences do you think need to be in place for perpetrators, and do you think they can be treated?
Since I believe that no one is born a perpetrator, I also have to believe that it is possible to heal from that. I think it takes an enormous amount of work. I've met some perpetrators that are on that road of recovery. I've even done a dialogue group between survivors and perpetrators. It's kind of like, you know, my dad was an alcoholic, and when I was a little girl back in the 40s and 50s, people didn't think drunks could recover. And that's been proven not to be the case. That doesn't mean all of them have, and it's not 100% sure that it's going to happen, but it is possible. And so I also hold out that belief that it is possible to recover from doing this. The tricky thing is, if we're talking child sexual abuse, is that a criminal justice issue or a public health issue? And I actually think it's kind of both, that it's like an epidemic we have of people mistreating children, and we can't just look at it from the criminal justice point of view, because these people are not going to all get locked up. So if we begin to approach it from a public health perspective, how to help people stop harming others, I think we might be getting somewhere. The other thing in terms of, what did you say, consequences? I think every perpetrator should be required to pay for the therapeutic cost of their victim. But that means they also have to admit that they've offended us. And, you know, that's a whole other shtick.
How much has this cost you in relationships, lost time at work, not just the monetary cost?
I've probably lost many opportunities for connection with other people and life throughout my life until I got healing, because I was too afraid to engage. I think that's a huge loss.
Now, did you black out some of the abuse? Did you have flashbacks later?
Yes. I always carried a certain level of awareness that my father had offended me, but there was a lot of the memories that I didn't hold consciously and didn't until I got into some pretty serious therapy stuff with EMDR. Because, you know, when it was happening, I would dissociate. I would send my mind to the window and count stars in the sky just to get out of my body so I wouldn't be paying attention to what he was doing. If I encounter guys that are very similar to my father, I can feel myself getting creeped out, and I'll have to remove myself from it in some fashion. I don't think all of that ever completely leaves, but I'm more aware of it now.
What do you think is the most important thing for people to know?
For every survivor, it wasn't your fault. Because when we boil it down, we end up thinking something, if only I this, if only I that. It's not our fault. And however we're coping with it is fine. And we're taking whatever time we need to get where we've got to go.
What about for people who are not survivors?
If someone tells you they're a survivor, don't question them. Just say your story that happened to them. It's not your job to try and figure out whether they're telling you the truth or not. It's not your job to fix them. For people who aren't survivors, it's a lot worse what happened to us than what's happening to you having to hear about this difficult piece of information. A way to get more survivors to come out is for others who are not survivors to be open to hearing what they have to say.
It kind of generates a fear that for a lot of people, if they know the red flags and they learn about this, you might find out there's somebody in your family like this, or your next door neighbor,
right,
or your minister.
Right. And people, I mean, I understand that humans have these constructions of families and communities, and these systems are very important to the daily life of everybody in them. And when you find something wrong in those systems, it becomes very scary that how are we going to fix this without unraveling the system? And I know that's true because when I came out to my family, I lost most of my family. I knew I was taking a big risk to finally tell that I was going to lose a lot of people I was connected to and cared about and wanted in my life. But it was more important for me to stop staying locked up inside. My sanity was more important than staying in that system. And I think a lot of those systems are going to have to get broken down before new ones can be built up.
What do you think about using a restorative justice model?
The raping of children occurs in closed systems, whether it's families, but you see this in religious institutions, you see it in the military, where there's not a lot of light being shown on what's going on inside of that place, right? And just what you're talking about, if you were to take a whole family or a whole community, and that when someone harms a child, they are confronted by the whole community, they have to account to their whole community, and the community has to figure out how to deal with members who are harming other members. And just to shun them and lock them away in secret and don't tell anybody doesn't go very far. I think your vision is right on target, Connie. Mm-hmm. And yeah, who knows? We might not see this in our lifetime, but it's a great vision to hold out for the future.
Well, like you said, if we're just locking them away, we're just repeating to them, and you know, in prisons, they're not mm-hmm. safe from mm-hmm. being sexually assaulted mm-hmm. themselves.
In my ideal situation would be someone rapes a child, they must be confronted. They must apologize. They must atone for it and make retribution for it. And they must never be left alone with a child ever again. Lots of work to do. But along with all the work, you got to find things to give you joy.
So what kinds of things give you joy?
Being with people that I laugh with. Writing. When I can write and see my words make sense, that gives me joy. Watching my grandson do anything, practically. Also, singing. I love to sing. I sing a lot in the car, very loud, by myself. And a quiet kind of joy is I do yoga. It's very calming and peacemaking inside me to do yoga.
I've found meditation helps a lot. Do you do that?
Yeah. I have a guided meditation tape that I listen to a couple times a week, and that really centers me also.
Thanks, Donna. And now we'll talk to Bill Murray. Tell me about NASCA.
NASCA is an organization that over the last decade or so began as a grassroots group for the purpose of discussing issues of child abuse and trauma in the public forum. We have two parts to our mission. The singleness of purpose of the mission is to discuss child abuse and trauma only, but of course there are a thousand topics in that. And we do it from two perspectives. One, to try to educate the public, to get them over the taboo and the fear of talking about child abuse issues. A lot of people will, of course, run for the hills if you bring child abuse up. They don't want to hear it. It doesn't belong to them. It's not an issue that affects their family, and so forth, none of which could be further from the truth. Now, the second part of our mission, of course, is to offer hope and healing to the still-suffering adult survivor of child abuse, of which there's approximately 45 million American adults who were victims of childhood sexual abuse. But when you add to that the number of people who suffered violent or physical abuse or emotional or mental trauma or neglected maltreatment, the numbers are absolutely staggering and overwhelming, and they should be shocking to anybody who doesn't know them. Of course, to those of us who are activists like myself, you know, we understand this is a pandemic that affects a huge number of our children, and that they all grow up after 18, they become adult survivors.
Talk about the statute of limitations.
If you want to find out what the statute of limitations is in your state, go to sol-reform.com and click on your state. All 50 states are listed there, and you'll see how long you have to bring either a civil suit or file a criminal offense against a perpetrator. And it's a matter of time. Usually it's measured a matter of years from when you became an adult or from your last offense as a child. Now, some of the states are absolutely draconian. They have a 3-year or a 5-year amount of time. Well, that's not even close to being appropriate. Most survivors, I think the average is probably in their 40s. In other words, they keep the secret for decades and come to the conclusion that they want to deal with it much later in life. So this is why statutes of limitations, from our perspective, part of what we wish is that these statutes would give at least some significant amount of time or be non-existent, like is the case with homicide and bank robbery, fraud and things like that. And as I said, most people don't come to the conclusion that this thing that's the very foundation of their life and has been affecting their life is something they want to deal with until they're in their 40s and 50s and 60s. And I have one woman in her 70s who just called me about a week ago. It doesn't matter when they come forward to us. We want to be there to help them. And I think society ought to feel the same way about survivors of child abuse, that, you know, whenever they have the willingness to come forward, we should honor that, and we should give them the opportunity to bring a case.
I've been a therapist over 2 decades, and I've seen a similar pattern. As a survivor, did you want to tell your story?
I'm a survivor myself, a survivor of childhood sexual abuse, child pornography that went on for many years. I'm also a victim of a kidnapping for 2 weeks, and I've been taken across not only state borders, but international borders into Canada and back. So I know these issues very well from the inside out. These things occurred to me when I was 11, 12, 13, and 14 years old, but they still are with me today. I'm now 35 years into my own recovery, approximately, and I still have, of course, I'm much more comfortable now that I'm healing, and I have been for a long time, but I'm still aware of the fact that these things are part of the foundation of my life and that they crop up from time to time. I'm still capable of being triggered. I'm still capable of having reactions to them. And I well understand that anybody that comes to NASCA for help feels a certain way. That's the universal thing. We know how each other feel and how each other think, and some of the actions that we took as a result of our childhood trauma are extremely similar, too.
Talk about how it is for men to come forward.
Now, of course, I'm a male survivor of child abuse. My perpetrators were all males. There were quite a few of them. The majority of them were priests and brothers in the Catholic Church. And I spent several years running away from them until I grew up and I was angry enough and I had a growth spurt and I was going to punch anybody in the face if they came on to me. Now, my reaction to that was that I was horrified by the prospect of being called a homosexual, which I wasn't. I was never attracted to men, and I didn't understand why they were attracted to me. Or B, people would insist that I go back to my church, which I left. I had a big problem with God, you know, and the Catholic Church. And when I came into recovery, I looked for places that I could get help. I had tried this many times before, and there was nothing. Of course, back then, they didn't even believe little boys could be sexually abused. But I knew better. And eventually I fell in with an organization that helped me separate myself from drinking and using, because I'd used alcohol and drugs for years heavily to sort of soothe myself as a solution to how horrible I felt about Bill. And I became an alcoholic. And in that group, I began to share about some of the issues that had driven me to drinking. And when the people in the group heard that, they were very supportive. I'll never be able to thank them enough. They said, "We don't have this in our past, but we can certainly hear how it's important to you. So you keep coming back and you keep talking about these issues." They gave me permission, in other words, to talk in the group, not only about my drinking, but what had driven me to drinking. And so I began to recover from drugs and alcohol, but also child abuse trauma 30-something years ago. Today, it's easier for males to find help, although there might be a hurdle that's unique to men because we're socialized to deal with things by ourselves and to buck up and to be a man and to put things behind us. And that kind of language is used when we're growing up. That once we decide to get into recovery, our recovery is identical to that of any other person. You have to act your way into recovery, which includes sharing in appropriate situations and appropriate groups and so forth with fellow survivors and or professionals who are trained in trauma therapy. And if you do that, there's no obstacle at all for male, female, black, white, gay, straight. And it's a worldwide problem and pandemic that has a worldwide solution.
What treatments do you find are most helpful besides the substance abuse treatment, you know, once you get past that?
NASCA doesn't proselytize about any particular treatment being any better than any other. What we do is we recognize there are a lot of legitimate paths to recovery from childhood trauma, and we talk about them all. The kinds of things I'm talking about are certainly therapy. Most people know about traditional psychotherapy with a trained therapist, by the way, who understands trauma. But there's also ministry. If you're comfortable with your own church, you might be able to find a path there. There's also, of course, psychiatry. Some people need medication in order to get even into the place where they can start to deal with their issues of child abuse. Some people get life coaches or other kinds of counselors. Some people do 12-step programs. That's what I did. If they'll allow you to talk about child abuse, that's very good. But there are many other nonprofit organizations that have their own peer-to-peer sharing groups. So you can do this individually with a single person, or you can do it with a group. Or I think the best is to have a combination of those. But also with the group, because it's in the group that you find out you're indeed not alone. You never have been alone. It's just the way it seems. But there are thousands and thousands and thousands around you who are dealing with the same issues all the time. And what a surprise that is, and a comfort. Now, in addition to all the things I've already mentioned, Connie, there's a lot of tools. There's things like hypnosis and body work and EMDR and art therapy and writing as a tool. What we do is we explain them all and we help them find the one that they would like to explore and we help them get involved with that.
That's great. As a therapist, I used to picture that it was my job to lay out the smorgasbord of choices and then see where, you
right.
know, where the client wanted to go.
Can I steal that from you?
Yeah, you can.
Smorgasbord?
Yeah. And personally, okay. I love equine therapy, riding horses, and music therapy, art therapy, those kinds of things. Yeah.
Exactly. Some people are physical, some people are not. I always say, you know, there are multiple things that you can do as part of your adulthood that deal with trauma. One which is to get justice, but the other one, part of which is to get healing. And some people will never get justice. Some people may have an opportunity to get justice that doesn't work, but everybody has an opportunity to heal. And that's our mission. Frankly, if you have to make a choice between one or the other, choose healing, because that affects your quality of life inside of you. It may not stop the predator, it may not bring justice into your life, but we're here to help in that way. And eventually, you realize that there's so much more to this than I ever thought. I would have shortchanged myself in recovery if I'd have been satisfied with what I thought I needed in order to get over it. You know, and 35 years later, I'm still learning. And one of the things that's missing in today's world is the sense that society around us is in this space of being terrified, frankly, of even dealing with the issue. They want to close their eyes to it. They want to turn their back to it. They want to run away from it or fight it. And what we need to do is accept it. It is there. It has been there for generations, and it probably will be for generations to come.
What do you want people to know about treatment?
It's worth it. It's hard, especially at first, but it's worth it. The quality of the rest of your life depends on what you do today. And what you do today only has to be making a tiny bit of progress for it to matter. Many people in recovery are interested in stopping their perpetrator principally because they don't want their perpetrator to affect other children. And they know that the perpetrator is probably likely to have abused other children and will go on doing so well into their adulthood, late adulthood. And in other words, it's an effort to stop the damage that can be done for future children.
What's the most important thing you want people to know?
We're trying to change society's mind about how they view the issue of child abuse and its trauma. Most people in society either run away from it or fight it, or they have a taboo about talking about it. And what we need to do is we need to change the mindset of the community so that they understand that indeed this is an issue that affects them, their community, their neighborhood, and probably their own family, and that they should care about it. One year, I think it was 2008, the Center for Disease Control, CDC, measured the cost of child abuse trauma as an inclusive thing, including incarceration of criminals and jurisprudence and therapies and lost wages, at $585 billion for that one year. $585 billion is a chunk of change. The fact of the matter is that we need to be out there, individuals coming out of the closet of their abuse, of their identity, breaking their own anonymity, over time to gain the trust of the community at large. Just a few years ago, it was measured that 52% of American public was willing to discuss issues of sexual identity. That's the same model that we have to think about with child abuse trauma. And that sense of being a community really matters. So these are some of the issues that I don't hear a lot of people talking about. You know what I hear? I hear them wagging their finger at the public. Don't you get it? You should understand. That's so contradictory to what we need to do.
Yes.
What we need to do is we need to go out there and say, we understand why you don't get it, because we didn't get it either before we got into recovery. And we were part of society, too. We were keeping the secret. We were scared to death of this issue. The majority of people are. It's terrifying, right, for most people. And we get that. So we need to invite them in and say, we understand you don't get it. Let us illustrate why it is important and give you some of the statistics and facts that maybe will leave you with a sense that this does affect you. It is in your community. You probably have it in your family and so forth.
Talk about when survivors come forward and people have a hard time believing them.
Children don't lie about it. I believe I saw a study where it was 98% of the time. Children tell the truth. They absolutely tell the truth. They need to be believed and they need to be supportive. They need to be not interrogated, but forensically interviewed by people who know how to talk to a child to get that actual story out factually. But once they do tell their story, you can absolutely believe them. Adult survivors, when they come forward, they may have a difficult time expressing themselves because they're so excited about the opportunity at first. But the basic story that they're telling should be believed. It should be taken seriously because you don't make a decision to come forward with a story of childhood sexual abuse unless you're serious about it. You don't make these things up. As children, the adults in our world were completely responsible, and yet we were taught somehow to be embarrassed about this, to feel shame about it, to even feel responsible about it. Somehow it's our fault, and it's never the child's fault, ever. And so we try to help people forgive themselves first.
Thank you, Bill. We're talking with Sarah Hodges from Beautiful Shame Campaign and Interform Fitness. Sarah, tell us about yourself.
I am a health and wellness coach here in Manhattan, and I created a company called Interform Fitness. It focuses more on fitness for living an optimal, healthy life versus looks. And we run a campaign called the Beautiful Shame Campaign, which helps people with eating disorders or victims of sexual abuse process the shame and blame through creativity. It's all about taking the trauma that we've experienced and the negative feelings that we feel about ourselves and turning them into something beautiful through creativity and healing through that.
So tell me, how did you get into this?
Well, I had a pretty long journey. I was actually a victim of sexual misconduct by a teacher when I was a late teen in high school. And I think he started making advances toward me that I didn't quite understand, probably starting around the age of 14. It was actually right after I graduated that he coerced me into an inappropriate sexual relationship. Meanwhile, the community tended to ostracize me. Nobody really understood sexual grooming at that time. This was, about 15 years ago? But at the time, that had an incredible effect on me, the way that I felt about myself, the way I felt about my body, and basically being able to move forward as a young woman.
How did it feel to be ostracized by the community?
That was probably the most painful part of all of it. I ended up engaging in a lawsuit with the school to make sure that my teacher could never teach again and that the school needed to take some responsibility, and ended up being in the news, and it was just extremely confusing for me at the time. I felt so much shame, and having that constant battle of being told that you're responsible by your community and yet knowing inside how much you're manipulated and how victimized you feel creates this constant internal struggle and an internal battle that I'm dealing with on a moment-to-moment basis.
Was your lawsuit successful in keeping him from teaching?
Yes, in that way it was very successful, and he agreed never to teach again.
A lot of times the teachers don't get prosecuted, or professors or church members, and they just get shuffled from one church to another, one school to another, one college to another, and the problem's not solved. So I'm glad you were successful with that.
Yeah, I am thankful that I had enough of a support system. And I'm looking back at my 18-year-old self. I'm very proud of that girl, that she was able to stand up and do what was right and follow it through to the end to make sure that he could not hurt another person.
How did the sexual abuse affect you?
Gosh, how did the sexual abuse not affect me? I think it still affects me to this day in my relationship with my body and my ability to not completely vacate my mind when I'm intimate with a man. But in the short term, right after, that's when we started having a lot of difficulties controlling my eating habits. I gained a whole lot of weight, about 90 pounds, and was extremely depressed to the point where sometimes I wouldn't leave the house for a month. And this was after the lawsuit. This was maybe 5 to 6 years later. And working with a therapist, I think that there was some issues of PTSD there and unresolved problems. Definitely a disconnection with my body and an avoidance of sexual intimacy or an inability to be truly present in sexual intimacy were the primary ways in which it affected me.
What has helped you the most in healing?
I think that self-compassion has helped the most in healing, because I went through this whole period where I was to blame, but I wasn't to blame. Like, oh no, he should have known better, but you also should have known better. I think that having compassion for myself for all of the errors that I make and recognizing that I can still be worthy of love and self-love in my imperfect state. And that's actually one of the major characteristics of Interform Fitness, is that this is all a process. We're not just working from goal to goal to goal, and help use that to cultivate and reconnect with our bodies. Because I think that especially after an experience of sex abuse, you do tend to disconnect from your body. You try to vacate it. You try to escape because your body has been violated and it feels so painful to be in it and connected to it. So giving it compassion and love and then reaching to connect with it again is probably the primary way in which I've been working at healing.
Now, tell me, how did you come up with the idea for the Beautiful Shame campaign?
One day when I was journaling, and I was talking a lot about the shame that I felt from my sex abuse. When I was writing, I said, I wish that I could take all the shame and tattoo it across my body and see all of these beautiful pictures instead of hiding it inside. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to paint it. I'm just going to paint all the things that I feel bad about and get it out there and put it on a canvas. And I'm just going to keep painting over it and over it and turn it into something beautiful. Really, at the end of the day, that's what art's supposed to be. It's supposed to be that raw emotion of our pain, our anguish, our deepest feelings put out in a way that can only be expressed through art because it's just too much for words. And I felt so much relief from that, and I felt so much encouragement from that I decided to start the campaign because I realized that a lot of these traumas, a lot of these shames that we feel in our life, and everyone feels them to some degree, really get in the way of health and fitness because they contribute to chronic stress throughout our life. And chronic stress is going to lower your immune system and make you unhealthier. So having a very concrete way to express some of that stress and trauma is, in my opinion, one of the first steps to health.
What's the most important thing that you'd like listeners to know?
Love yourself. This does not define you. They're going to grow from this. They're going to become stronger. And if they do that with love and they don't allow it to define them, they'll come out the other end. And not necessarily be glad for it, because you're never glad for it, but see it as part of your experience and not let it be your only experience. Of really specific advice that I can give to an abuse victim is, to the best of your ability, try not to completely disconnect from your body. Treat it with the respect and love and care that it deserves, even though there's someone in your life who hasn't. That's what I want to say.
Can you also address the connection between stress and the autoimmune system in your body?
So great that more people are becoming aware of the connection between stress and your immune system, because I think that a lot of people look at a program like Interform Fitness and they're like, why is it so based in body awareness and reducing your stress and creativity? Like, that's not, I can't do that at the gym, but having a calorie deficit like a diet or doing exercise at the gym is going to add stress to your body. So if you're going to be adding stress from fitness or dieting, then you need to also be relieving it in some way, or you still have an extremely high stress level that's compromising your immune system over time. You want to lower that overall stress in your daily life so that you can become more fit over time. If you just do the fitness aspect of it and not the stress-reducing aspect of it, you're only increasing your stress. You know, exercise is like a prescription. You have to know just the right amount to take. But the problem is that amount changes day to day, year to year, depending on your stress level, depending on your energy expenditure throughout the day. And without having good body awareness, it's really hard to understand how much is the right amount for you.
Thanks, Sarah. And now we'll talk with Rachel. Why is criminal sexual conduct underreported?
Well, a number of reasons. The main one being that most victims of any kind of sexual crime feel an immense amount of shame and fear. The shame being because of its sexual nature. There's the physical shame, but also the emotional and mental shame as well. There's a huge psychological component to that. And so coming forward with what happened, they feel embarrassed and humiliated. And there's a huge amount of victim shaming. Well, what were you wearing? What did you have anything to drink? As if they are responsible for the perpetrator's behavior, which is ridiculous because we're never responsible for someone else's behavior. And that is part of what needs to change in the fabric of our society. But there it is. And then another component, of course, is fear. As a survivor myself, I was 11 when I was abused by our neighbor, and he was an adult man, a father. I was terrified. He had a gun. He threatened myself, my family, my baby sister. She was a year old. And there is that fear that for for our lives or the lives of our loved ones. So by coming forward, we are terrified that something horrible will happen.
What do you think is the extent of the problem of sexual abuse?
It's difficult. The statistics are even more significant when you look at the number of assaults that occur to children under the age of 18, 1 in 3 girls, 1 in 6 boys, and 90% will know their perpetrator. So we really have to teach our kids to be aware of the people closest around them, because unfortunately, child molesters are the ones who typically will take the jobs to be closest to children. And that's what's really sad and scary. And so we have to just be really, as parents or guardians, we have to be on our guard about it. And there's so much psychological and emotional grooming that goes on because the children feel so confused and betrayed by what happened.
When you went through this process, is there anything looking back that you would want to tell law enforcement or whoever was advocating for you, anything that they could have done differently?
Well, my parents, they really did not understand the value of therapy. I was not put into therapy. They basically just swept it under the rug, minimized and dismissed it, basically saying things like, well, what happened to her wasn't as bad as the other girls, and thought in their ignorance that they were helping me by minimizing it. You're okay, you're fine, just go about your schoolwork, hang out with your friends, do your thing. And by telling me that it was really no big deal, I internalized all of it and ended up without having the language or understanding, really, until I became a parent, to understand how damaging that was. And that's something that I advocate for now for survivors, because it ended up showing up in other ways by being a perfectionist, by trying to control my weight, by having panic attacks and anxiety and depression. And ultimately, all of that became such a huge umbrella of post-traumatic stress for me that I still are. Hypervigilance, that was huge for me, and it still is. I think that became such a big deal without me even realizing it or understanding it. And that's what I ended up writing about in my book. And so I would tell people that it's okay to feel what you're feeling and not try to hide it. And it's okay to ask for help and to let people know around you that you're struggling, and to tell them, don't minimize or dismiss what I'm going through. This is a big deal. And that you're not being a victim, because you are a victim. We were victims of horrific crimes. And that is a police term. That is a law enforcement term, being a victim of a crime. That's not something to be ashamed of. And I think that's a big problem that we have in society at large, is just talking about it and trying to get help for it doesn't make us a quote-unquote perpetual victim. It makes us a survivor, discussing issues that are real, that we suffer from. And it's okay.
I think that's such an important point that you brought up, that your parents thought they were being helpful by saying, don't mm-hmm. worry about it, go out and play, think about something else. I see that so much in society too. I think people are constantly healing and growing emotionally, physically.
I agree. I do feel that we move through various stages, from victim to survivor to thriver. And we can move through those stages at any point. For example, I feel I'm in the thriver stage, and I am a successful businesswoman and author, and I'm a mother, and I don't feel that I'm in a victim stage. But I can be hit by a trigger without even realizing what that trigger might be. A loud noise, for example, can, you know, raise my heart rate and cause me to panic. And I don't know that that noise is coming, so I can't prepare for that. And so I can, you know, go right back into that victim stage. And it may just last a few minutes. But a quote-unquote normal person who hasn't been through that kind of trauma would look at me like, what the heck is wrong with you, lady, right? They cannot relate to me whatsoever. but they haven't lived what I've lived through. And so I think there needs to be more understanding. For example, if that person, let's say they were in the room with a war veteran suffering from PTSD, they'd say, okay, yeah, I totally get it. We get that. There needs to be that same understanding for sexual assault trauma. The effect on the brain is the same, regardless of what the incident was, an accident or, you know, earthquake or whatever. So why do we not give the same kind of understanding and compassion to a sexual assault survivor? So I think as survivors, we need to understand that recovery is possible. I used to reject that term because I thought, well, recovery is for addicts. And it wasn't until I started with a trauma-trained therapist that I understood that there are these effects on the brain, and I do have PTSD, and I need to work on ways to understand what was happening to me and how to have the tools to recognize what was happening and how to deal with it when it does happen. And for so many therapists who are treating survivors of sexual trauma to have that training, because so many don't, and that's what's really sad.
When you mention the veterans, it's not a DSM diagnosis of false memory, but that comes up sometimes when you're talking about women remembering child sexual abuse. And when veterans come back and they have flashbacks, they're not told they have false memories.
Right. I do think there's a bias against women who are survivors. It's twofold. One of the statistics is that 94% of sexual abuse perpetrators are men. And that is taking into account prisons as well. So if you take that into account, men are the principal perpetrators of sexual abuse. But the bias is definitely, if women come forward, they are immediately doubted. So there is a huge amount of sexism and bias against women who come forward. Why that is, I don't know if it's because of our patriarchal society. I don't know. It's very sad. On the other side of it, for men, it's very difficult for a man to come forward and say that he was sexually abused. There's a wonderful organization for men called oneinsix.org, as well as RANGE. If you want to come forward and tell your story, then please tell your story. But if you feel like it's too much to talk about it publicly, then don't. You own that, and that's your agency to share that if you feel it will help somebody else or it will help you.
I saw the other day there was a petition online to have all veterans have brain scans before they go into the military. And I thought, actually, it might be very interesting to do that. It would point out a lot of the people who already have PTSD before they even go in the military.
I think the changes in our brain, and when you look at somebody who has not been sexually abused versus somebody who has been sexually abused, it's stunning, the difference in the areas of the brain. And I do believe that it affects your body as well.
Yes, the autoimmune system can be activated by a lot of stress and trauma.
Yeah, there's no question. On Sex Abuse Chat, we've discussed autoimmune disorders, and I can't tell you how many people who come to the chat who have something. Thyroid disorders are extremely common, as well as arthritis, especially rheumatoid arthritis, which is autoimmune, and several other types of autoimmune disorders. It's rife within the survivor community.
Yes, I saw a lot of survivors in my own practice that they almost always had other physical symptoms too.
Yeah, absolutely. And then when we talked about eating disorders, I don't think there was one person who came to the chat who did not display some sort of an issue with food. Everybody has some kind of a story with regard to being a survivor and having an eating disorder of some sort. It affects us in so many ways. And so when people tweet me or send me Facebook messages, just get over it, they have absolutely no idea the range of effects that it has on us. And I think growing up, we have no idea that our behaviors are being affected. I had no idea why I was driven to work out 4 hours a day, or why I would only eat an apple, or why I would check my door and window 3 times before I would go to sleep, and then I'd lay there for 4 hours listening for somebody to break in.
Yes, the hypervigilance. What else are survivors telling you?
Across the board, with regard to the stories that people tell me, not one of them has ever felt the need to abuse. They're so appalled by what happened that they pretty much just shut down. So many of our community don't want to be touched, don't want to touch others. And for me, it would never have occurred to me to abuse somebody else. I'm such a nonviolent person anyway. I'm not saying violence has anything to do with sexual abuse, but the thought of harming somebody else is so abhorrent to me. And to ever cause anyone else that kind of trauma is unthinkable.
I think it's a really important point to stress that survivors, they have a choice whether or not to speak out, and they need to balance that with taking care of themselves. Say more about that.
Well, self-care is huge, and it's something that as survivors we tend to put on the back burner. We're not used to giving attention and care to ourselves, and it's hard because so many of us suffer from a kind of low self-esteem. We're not worthy. We still feel that shame or guilt or fear or responsibility for what happened to us. It's something that so many people have taken to the point where they don't feel they deserve any kind of nice things. So they won't allow themselves to take a nice bath with some scented candles or go for a run or exercise or make a nice meal or do nice things just for themselves. And when it comes to taking care of ourselves, a lot of times we just don't because we feel like we don't deserve it. And to address the other part of what you were saying, a lot of times some people are just not ready to tell their story. My mantra is write what scares you. And people are absolutely terrified by that. What if my mom reads it? What if my boss reads it? What if my neighbors won't talk to me anymore? And I tell people, you survived the abuse. You can survive writing about it. And nobody ever has to read it if you don't want them to. But if you want them to, you can still write about it and then decide what to do with it later. But it's still so therapeutic to write about what scares you and not worry about the public reading it. Because most people are not going to read what you wrote. They're really not all that interested. And it's okay to share your story. You have nothing to be ashamed of. Children don't sexually abuse themselves. No victim is ever to blame for someone else's behavior. And if that's the only message I can get across, that would be it.
Thank you for listening to this segment of Criminal Sexual Conduct, What Needs to Change, produced by WUVS-LP and Connie Nesbury International, LLC. For full speaker bios and transcripts, visit ConnieNesbury.com, that's ConnieNesbary.com. Expressed opinions do not necessarily reflect the view of WUVS-LP or Connie Nesbury International, LLC. For support, call the RAIN hotline at 800-656-4673. Be sure to listen next time for more on this topic.